Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints, and I am so totally excited. Today we have a celebration of the 25th edition of My Heart's Desire by author Andrea Kane, and we're going to talk about that book today, and the second one, Samantha, on Thursday. So good morning, Andrea. How are you today?
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. I'm so excited. And this book is, like, really exciting. So tell everybody the 25th edition of this book and why you decided now to showcase it even more.
First of all, I guess I'm a true romantic at heart because it's my first baby. So I sat down and thought, I cannot believe it's been 25 years. I mean, that's like a lifetime since I published my first book. So I was reading it, and I was thinking this would be, you know, a lovely gift sort of to my readers to give them some of my backstories of how I wrote it and some of the funny anecdotes that went along with it. So we decided to repackage it and do everything that went along with that and then add some of my stories and put it out in the 25th anniversary edition.
That's exciting to have 25 years of writing. My God, it's great.
Thank you.
My computer... It is. It's great. So tell everybody the backstory about how you came to write this.
You know, the funny thing about my writing is even to this day, I usually start with a character. There's just something about something that pops in my head about a character, and then that character kind of marinates in my head for a while, and the story spins from that. So it was Alex that just came. I just kept having this vision of this young woman who was part of a really rigid aristocracy in Regency England and who just didn't want to go with the flow and decided that, you know, she wasn't going to, and she was going to stow away on this ship and take off her parts unknown. And when I did that, then Drake popped up. I thought, oh, God, talk about the antithesis. This is, or actually, in some ways, the opposite, in some ways, the identical. And it started from that. That's really where it started. And I love Regency England. I love researching there, and I think I've set so many stories there at this point, and I love seeing people go against the grain because that's my personality too.
Yeah, it is mine too. That's probably why Lady Alexandra, you know, reminded me of me because I don't listen either. It's amazing. So, what facts did you have to change in regard to the sailing of La Belle Illusion in order to make the story come alive? And how did you come up with that name?
Well, you know, it's just because it really was a beautiful illusion, and that was, it seemed to fit so perfectly because the whole book was an illusion in certain ways that turned out to be both an illusion and a truth, which I kind of thought was an interesting, juxtaposition. I like that together. But as far as, you know, I always try my best to be as historically accurate as possible. But in order to tell a story, sometimes that, you know, you need to do a little. So the only things that I really tweaked, and I think I actually put in an author's note saying that, is that the Drake's ship, La Belle Illusion, would have been way, way too big a merchant vessel to be able to pass through what was then the tiny little skinny and shallow St. Lawrence Seaway. To get through to what was then Little York and is now Toronto. So I made it possible for that to be able to happen because it needed to get there. So I did that. And also, Little York, as I said, which is now Toronto, is I did that as accurately as I could, but I sort of upped it a little bit in terms of Fort York, a series of log huts, more or less, instead of something more grand, and certainly the governor's house, which I with Jeffrey Cassell, you know, Alexandria's father, lived there. I made it much grander. The truth is it was just a simple one-story frame house. It wasn't a big mansion. So it was just those kinds of little things to add and embellish a drop. But I always put in an author's note then because I feel like I owe people the truth and they know historically what was going on. You know, I do that. And I don't think I tweaked much more. I mean, most of it really was the way it was.
That is interesting. That's interesting. So Drake and Alexandria, his first reaction to her was priceless, of course. And her reaction to him, she knew she had him right from the get-go. So how did you create them? I thought that was so cool. You know, he's not going to let her do blah, blah, blah. And she decided what she was going to wear, and she decided what she was going to do. And it was hilarious. That was hilarious. So how did you get them? The sparks were right there. I mean, there was no doubt about it, but the sparks were right there between the two of them.
You know what's funny? One of the first things that I thought of to put into the first scene where she actually saw him and he didn't see her when she was under his berth in his cabin,
mm-hmm.
was the scene where she was looking at his legs. Like, she had never seen naked legs on a man before, and I was attracted she was to his legs. And I just thought that was a very interesting first view, because it's not usually someone's legs that you see first, but I just mm-hmm. really got a kick out of that. And then, as I said, between their two personalities, it just, you know, and the other thing that popped into my head was basically him walking down there exhausted, ready to just sort of hang out and go to bed, and have her sitting there going, when will luncheon be served? I'm very hungry. And his expression, just the whole interchange there, I really, really enjoyed writing that.
Well, I'll tell you, she's my kind of person, because she could kill us, what anybody thought. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm just cracking up. I go, like, she's, like, so outspoken and so into herself, my God. So what did you create a story that with the lead character would be like this and still away on the ship? And when he met her, what did he think when he saw her the first time?
Well, as far as Alex, I think that Alexandria, I think that it was a combination of boldness but also innocence, because I don't think she had the slightest clue that her father mm-hmm. was going to receive her that way. She had this fairy tale in her head that he was going to welcome her to Canada and, you know, and introduce her to these wonderful things, and she'd sail and she'd be free, and she wouldn't be part of the, you know, the tight rules of the aristocracy, when in mm-hmm. fact she fell right into that. I mean, she unfortunately undid herself. So there was an innocence there, but there was also a determination of, I'm not going to be dancing with these simpering men who are staring at my bosom and thinking about, you know, how they want to court me and marry me and then stick me in a gilded cage. So it was sort of both. And then as far as his reaction, first he was stunned, and then he was furious. I mean, first of all, he has no great affection for women except in bed to begin with. He doesn't think much of women. And here's this little 5-foot nothing sitting in his cabin, on his precious ship where no woman has ever set foot, demanding lunch and expecting, you know, to be taken along, no problem, I'll pay my way and you can take me to Canada. So he was livid. He was, and Drake gets livid a lot. So that was not a happy scene for her.
That was hilarious, because he's not used to anybody just, you know, saying, oh, I'll do whatever you want, I'm the captain of the ship, blah, blah, blah. And it didn't matter to her. So she finally made friends with Smitty. Tell us about him. He was a cool character. And he could do anything and say anything to Drake. He's great. I like Smitty.
I love Smitty, too. It's funny because what I pictured right from the beginning when I created Smitty was, for some reason, I don't always picture someone in particular, but it was the Disney version of Smee in Captain Hook Smee in Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. That kind of loving, kind of, you know, really, he was extremely committed, and he was warm and kind of like somebody's father or grandfather and just a caring man at the same time as he was, you know, a strong guy who had to do what he had to do. And it was also a wonderful way to show the softer side of Drake, because that was one person who was really his best friend besides being his first mate and his valet. He was really his closest friend and the closest thing to a father he had. And he related to him in a way that, you know, most people would say, oh, come on, no one would tolerate that from an underling.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, because Smitty was Smitty. And then when Alex met him, there was he had that same protective quality where it came to her. He also knew where Drake's anger came from, who Drake really was. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt very protective because he knew that this was not going to go well on the topical level when the two of them first got together. So he sort of played monkey in the middle a lot, trying to, you know, make her stay more comfortable, recognizing that she was used to a whole different world, and she was going to be a bunch of raucous men and a really surly captain. So he spent a lot of time doing that, and I think she loved him as a father.
Well, she was really. I mean, she ingratiated herself. She even played whist with the crew. He must have really, you know, looked at her playing whist with the crew and just joining in and helping. That must have set him off also. So that's really amazing.
Everything, the fact that, and also the fact that she got the cook to do things differently. Everything that
she
did,
to cook anything that
he was concerned. As far as he was concerned, she upturned his entire ship. His crew was completely, you know, and it wasn't so much that they were lusting after her either. They were really enjoying her. Mm-hmm. She was a member of the crew. She was helping. She was playing whist with them. She was, you know, she just was so bewildered every time he got angry because she thought she was doing a great thing. She was a really good sailor. She certainly had never sailed a merchant brig, but she was, you know, she had small skiffs and things at home, and she was a really good sailor, so she thought she was helping out, and the crew loved it, and Drake hated it.
No, I know he did, because he's a macho man. But
yes,
well, he was gone before he started. So what happens on this voyage that changes his life and makes him realize, I think I met my match, and I'm going to have to deal with it. I mean, there was some of the scenes were just absolutely priceless.
I think that some of the things, especially when there was anything going on with the ship, when there was a major, like when there was the awful storm, and she refuses to obey his orders all the way through, and she comes up and helps, and he screams at her to go down below, and that, of course, doesn't happen. But I think also as they would talk, you know, and it would start out adversarially, but they would have conversations where I guess they were kind of learning. In a way, they were kindred spirits. They both had the same baggage for different reasons. They had a connection that was more than just sexual. There was something there that, and I think that she started getting under his skin. Now, of course, she also got under his skin sexually, which didn't help because, you know, when you want to hate someone and you want them instead, this is not a good combination. So the fact that he was so interested in taking her to bed, and he was absolutely convinced that she was this experienced, you know, prostitute, because every woman was, and here she was, an innocent young woman who'd never been with a man. And I think that one of the most crucial moments for him was when he actually realized this untouched young woman is really a virgin. She's never been with a man. She is as innocent as she professes to be. She's not a liar. She's not a courtesan. Mm. She's really an untouched young woman who's just trying to experience life for the first time. And I think that really kind of undid him.
Yeah, it unglued him, that's for sure. But then she had to sleep in his cabin, and he had his other ideas on there. And she was able to sort of make him understand that that wasn't going to happen. Because I was surprised.
I think that
she
was so
stunned
when he basically announced that they were sharing the cabin. I thought she was going to die. And then, of course, you know, having to change her clothes and actually asking him to turn around because he's just not used to that. It's, you know, to him it was a ridiculous facade of being maidenly outraged, you know, but he turned around and she put on one of his huge billowy white shirts. And I think that what happened was when they both were, the lights were doused and they were each in their respective beds, she got up and she went to wash up and bumped into the cot and started to cry. And when he heard the thump, he jumped up too to see if she was okay. And I think that when they kind of came together for the first time, I think that that's when he realized it, because I think I wrote something like she needed comfort. He needed more. He was just like, oh God, I really want this woman and this is bad and this is everything I don't need and I'm leaving. So he just, she had no understanding, he just sort of stormed down and said, I'll bunk down with Smitty goodbye, and slammed the door. And she was left staring after him thinking, you know, what the heck, question mark. And then she was delighted she had the cabin to herself.
I don't blame her.
No,
I don't either. I'm looking at it, and he called her princess. And he called her princess in Samantha, too. He's always called her princess.
Yes.
So I mean, because she really is a princess. She really is a princess.
I think that that throughout the whole book, until he actually realized he was in love with her, it was kind of a sarcastic term. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, princess. And then by the end, she was his princess, and he did love her, and that became a word of endearment.
Yeah, but she was amazing. But I'm going to get to a different character in just a moment. So why doesn't he, he didn't believe her. The father, she comes to see the father, and he is furious when she tells him what happened. What does he want her to do? I mean, he's going to force her to do something she doesn't want to do. And you know, Alexandra, she wasn't going to put up with that.
She was so stunned because, again, she expected him to just welcome her with open arms because he is her father. And just to accept that nothing happened and everything was fine and here she was. But the rules of the Tan, which is, you know, the aristocracy in those days, they believed that a young woman of that kind of nobility was to be chaperoned at all times, even when she went out just for a ride in the park. She always had her chaperone with her, her lady's maid, who usually was. And she took this unprecedented trip across the globe to see her father with not only no chaperone, but an entire ship full of men. And that's compromised in the absolute worst way. There's no way that they could ever say she wasn't a fallen woman because that's just the way things were then. So I think at first his reaction was just rage, but then, see, the one twist here is that Alex had no idea who Drake really was and that he was actually a nobleman himself, but Jeffrey Cassell did because he had done business with him before and he knew him. And when he saw him and realized who this guy was who had ruined her, so to speak, and realized that whether or not they had slept together, it didn't matter. But the fact was that idea of it, the illusion of it was there regardless. He thought this is great because all he ever wanted was to marry her to a nobleman who had tons of money and tons of stature. And that's exactly what he would get. So he didn't tell Alex at first. He basically told her to run off. But when he and Drake had their conversation, he told him that he would ruin his family name if he didn't marry her because that was the way he was going to get his revenge and also take care of his daughter, get her off his hands because she was a pain in the butt to him. She was he actually had wanted a son, as all men did in those days. And she was not only a daughter but a very unconventional pain daughter. And he just was thrilled to unload her and to unload her in that particular way, to give her to someone who was a future duke and who had tons of money. Was, you know, every father's dream in those days. So that's the way he handled it. How Alex reacted was she just felt terribly betrayed. She listened to her father and realized that she really couldn't say no. But first of all, in spite of her being such a ballsy person, it still was her father. And she wasn't going to tell him, you know, to go suck wind. You know, she wasn't going to listen to him. But on the other hand, she also realized that what she had done did compromise her. Her biggest concern was how did Drake react? And because Drake overheard her talking to her father the way she was, he came in like a raging bear. So they went into this, both of them, thinking, I don't want to do this and I don't want to be with you and I can't believe I have to marry you. So that was the big thing, having to get married when neither of them planned to by any means.
Well, I'll tell you, it sounds like something my grandfather would have done when I was younger. Yep, he would. He would say to me, you know, they tried an arranged marriage. They did. And I said, there was no way that was going to happen. And it wasn't that I didn't like the person. It was just that he was too orthodox for me. And I said, okay. And his parents knew that my grandfather was orthodox, but they didn't approve of the fact that we were more conservative. So I lucked out. And he didn't really luck out because they chose somebody for him. And he told me that he didn't like her. So he had to deal with that also. So it didn't always work out.
It's hard to spend your life with somebody. I mean, in this case, at least they had the sexual sparks going for them. But, I mean, usually it's this kind of, okay, here I am. Like as you would say, you know, it's exactly as you just described. You know, it's like Tevye and Golda. You know, do you love me after 25 years? You know, because they got married without ever having seen each other before.
Yeah, I know. As a matter of fact, it was the rabbi's son, and he was working with me with my Hebrew to make sure that I did better, and I wanted some extra help. And he said, My father just introduced me to this girl. He says, "Oh my God, you have no idea." And he started to describe her. I said, "Well, maybe she's a nice person. I want to be mean." He says, "You got to tell me what I'm going to do to get to stop it." I said, "Then you know what? Your parents are going to have to understand that this is not who you want to marry, and you're going to have to figure out how to tell them to get out of the binding, because obviously they signed, they signed already that when he was whatever to marry her, and he didn't marry her. He married somebody that looked just like his mother. They introduced him to somebody else. Yeah, and his mother was beautiful, so he said he was much happier. I said, well, and he would have married me if they would have agreed, but I was glad they didn't, because I was not ready at 18 years old.
You're probably happier now.
Yeah, 18 years old. I was just graduated college. I was just starting my career. I didn't want to do that. So what happens to change the fact that she married him? And now she's got to do whatever he says and go wherever he tells her to go.
That wasn't happening as far as she was concerned. Her attitude was going to be that she she was staying here and he was going back to England, and that was fine with her, so she'd be married in name only, and then she could do whatever she wanted and stay in Canada. But that's not what Drake had in mind, and certainly not what her father had in mind. So,
right.
Of course, at that particular point, when they were still at the arguing stage, that's when the War of 1812 broke out. And that was what changed everything, because they had to get home in a hurry, because America had just declared war on England. And suddenly it was get in the ship, let's get going, let's get out of here.
Yeah, that was probably a turning point in the book, too. So what happens when she meets his father and his Sebastian, ooh, nasty man.
Yeah.
How do we know that there's something off with the brother? Oh, he was a good villain, let me tell you. He was
a good villain.
He was evil. I said, I knew you weren't going to let me down. After reading The Murder That Never Was, which I couldn't put down once I started it, and I'm waiting for your next murder novel to come out, because that was fantastic. This guy, so how did you create Sebastian? And when she meets his father and his brother, what happens?
Well, I think that, first of all, she doesn't know the entire trip back, the truth, because, I mean, Smitty keeps telling Drake, would you tell her the truth? And he keeps saying he will, but it just never seems to be the right time. And, of course, now they're married. So now that they're married, all of his sexual fantasies can come to life. So he's busy enjoying her that way, and also in the meantime fighting the idea of battle going on, which eventually, unfortunately, did happen, which we could talk about later on. But, there was obviously a lot of danger going home, and he never did tell her. So when they got to London, she still had no idea. And he found out as soon as they docked that his father was very ill and dying, and he of course wanted to go straight to him. I mean, he's the eldest son. It's him, then Sebastian, then Samantha. So he's the eldest son, and he's devastated. He loves his father dearly. So he goes running back to the ship and then tells Alex, what's happening, and we have to get going and everything else. And her heart is broken for him, because she cares for him deeply, and she actually has sort of acknowledged at this point she's in love with him. And not only to herself, not to him, of course. But she, of course, goes immediately to his side, and they go back to his family estate, which is Allenshire, is like 12 city blocks long and, enormously huge with turrets. And she assumes that his father is one of the tenants that lives on the grounds and works the land, so to speak. And she's just, brokenhearted for him. So they go with this kind of assumption on her part, and she's just going to comfort him, and she's in a very soft, vulnerable state. And they pull up to the front door, which she just doesn't understand. The carriage takes them to the door as opposed to around back or to one of the smaller places that, where the tenants live. And they walk in the door, and of course, Drake is now completely unshaven, unkempt. He doesn't look the way he normally looks when he's here. So when they come in through the front door, their butler comes running out and says, deliveries are made around back, et cetera, et cetera. And Drake just says, thanks, basically, you don't recognize me. And his jaw drops, and he says, my lord. And as soon as he says that, Alex is kind of like, my lord. And as the pieces start falling quickly into place, because it happens so fast because his father's dying, Neither Samantha or Sebastian are there at that particular moment, so they go running upstairs, and he's dragging her along in his wake, and she's just in shock. She's in total shock, and I think that the only thing, and this refers to what you just asked me, I think that what keeps her together is when she sees his father, because he's a good, kind man who's on his deathbed, and there's no way that she's going to come in and rip into him about his son, and she's just, you know, a kind person in spite of all of her faults. She just is heartbroken, and she has to stand there, and she does tell him that she cares deeply for Drake and that, you know, that she'll be there for him. And he understands more, actually, in some ways, that he knows her father. So she realizes, oh, that's right, you would know my father. You travel in the same circles. Yeah, the pieces are slowly falling into place for her. And so her reaction to Grayson is just very much, my heart breaks for you, and your son will be okay, and I'll make sure he's okay. So she holds it together until she leaves the room, and then she kind of falls apart. And Smitty, as always, is there for her to just sort of just tell her it'll be okay. Now, she's furious at him, of course, because no one's told her anything. Everyone knew everything except her. The whole crew knows who he is. But she didn't, and the fact that Smitty didn't tell her either, she feels as a betrayal as well. So in a very bad state, waiting in the hall, then what happens is Drake comes out, tells her that he's passed, and she intends to just sequester herself in a room and be left alone, and then he hears Samantha come home, and he asks if she'll meet his sister, because she's only 15, and she's going to be devastated by this news. So they go downstairs, and she meets Samantha, and Sammy is, well, you know, you and I will talk more about her on Thursday, but she's a breath
she's
of
cool.
fresh air, and I loved her from the minute she was born, and so did my readers, so there was never a doubt she'd get a book, but at that point, she was Drake's little sister. She was devastated by the fact that their father had died. I mean, she was just feeling she was all alone in the world for obvious reasons. We'll get to Sebastian in a second. But she felt all alone. And then Drake came in. Now, she thought Drake was dead. And seeing him alive and whole and there just changed everything for everybody. So Alex was witnessing this kind of loving exchange between brother and sister and realizing that, you know, there's more here. There's depth and there's love and there's something that this beautiful young woman sees in her brother. And then she has very little time to think about that because Drake is kind of standing off to the side and in comes Sebastian, who's a snake of the lowest order.
He hates him too. I know. You could tell.
He hates Drake's guts, you know, and it's clear from the beginning he hates him because he wants everything that he's entitled to, you know, the title, the money.
Yeah.
Everything. And when he comes in, it's really clear from the minute he comes in that he's a really ugly man. You don't know how evil he is, but you know he's an ugly man because when he walks in and Sammy tells him, you know, that their father's dead, he's kind of whistling and it's sort of like, you know, I'll take care of everything. Don't worry. You know, I'm in charge now. And then Drake steps out and says, no, I'll take care of everything. And Sebastian sort of turns green and then white. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons that he's stunned to see Drake, but most of all, he just is miserable. And he's so, and then he looks, I remember because when he said it, he kind of said it himself. Sometimes I'm kind of a conduit where I am writing, but I'm not thinking of it. They're telling me, they're sort of telling their story and I'm putting it on paper. So I remember when he first said, and who is this tempting little morsel, when he was looking at Alex. And I just hated him so much at that moment. I thought, you animal, you're such an animal. Your father just died, and you're lusting after some strange woman who's standing in your hallway. You don't even know who she is, which Drake tells him immediately. And he's just appalled by that, too. Everything he's planning is just unraveling. And he's, as I said, he's just a very mean and ugly character, and the full extent of his ugliness, I obviously won't touch on the very last stage because that's the twist at the end, which we'll stay away from. But he's just everything that I think that you would grow to hate. But interestingly, and this goes for all my books, you know, my thrillers and my historicals, one of the things that I learned, I had a writing teacher once who said, every villain is a hero in his own mind forever, because it's true. No villain is a cardboard figure of evil. It's just in their mind they've created a story about themselves that's real, and he believes he's entitled to all this. He believes that he was there to work the land, not work physically work the land, but direct traffic, so to speak, and do everything that a the elder son should be doing, because Drake was always sowing his wild oats on board the ship and off, and he didn't do any of those things. So Sebastian ran the place and thought, well, I'm entitled to the place. Whereas Drake was doing things for his country as opposed to doing things for his home. But his father was okay with that, because he was still alive. He was still the Duke. Everything was running smoothly. And Drake wasn't needed in that capacity. But Sebastian, in Sebastian's mind, he was the heir apparent. He deserved this. He didn't get this. And this was going to be a big transitional point where everything went up in flames. And Alex, of course, disliked him immediately, especially when she watched him lusting after her, even after Drake said, this is my wife. So this was going to be a very ugly situation, but it also was going to be one that I think it had a little bit of the distraction for Alex. So she wasn't just hating Drake this whole time. She was dealing with this at the same time. So I guess that was a long-winded answer, but that's the answer.
Yeah, well, he wanted her, too, the minute he saw her. I know.
Yes.
Sebastian had this thing, well, if I get rid of my brother, if I get the wife. Not so, no, not really. But the ending, I won't say, the ending was good. That like, is going to get everybody like, what? And I had a feeling. And, I mean, he was whistling with his father. That's scary. So, Samantha and Alexandria take to each other in 10 seconds. And when we're going to talk about Samantha on Thursday, they sort of have the same personality, the two of them.
In certain ways they do, in certain ways they don't. I think Sammy is much more, but also remember that Alex had no one. She grew up with a mother who was, you know, was exactly what an aristocratic woman should be. She was a noble woman to the core, so she was off doing her party thing. And her father was, you know, completely across the country, excuse me, the world. So she was on her own with no siblings. Sammy grew up with Drake's love and her father's love. So their mother was long gone, but she had her father and she had Drake, and she adored them both. So she had more of a loving upbringing. So I think that made her softer, and not without that she didn't have Alex's edge, I think, at that particular point. But they both were rebels in their own right. They each, you know, they both loved the same thing, and that was freedom. And I think that, you know, that Samantha, first of all, the first thing before anything is seeing her brother as happy as he was, even though he didn't know he was happy, but she did, with woman's intuition. I think women are born with that, even when they're two, and men never acquire it, even when they're 52. So, but I think that from the beginning, she saw how good Alex was for Drake, and she just saw also this wonderful, she had all of the misconceptions of Alex that, well, not that Drake had, because his were negative, but Samantha thought that Alex was a beautiful, young, noble woman who had, you know, captured her brother's heart, and they'd gotten married in some beautiful ceremony in the grand ballroom in Toronto. And here is Alex telling her, no, that's not the way it happened. And she told her, I stowed away aboard your brother's ship. And Samantha's sort of, you know, her reaction was, oh, my God, because she knows Drake so well. And it's like, how could a woman ever do that and get away with it and come home alive? Because he would kill them. Alex was trying to comfort her through, and the similarities between their personalities. And Alexandria is only 18, and that's not that much older than, you know, she had not yet blossomed into. It's interesting because, you know, as you said, we'll talk about Samantha on Thursday, but in those couple of years, it's only several years, Alexandria becomes a woman, and she, you know, grows into a different kind of a stage of life, so to speak. But here, she's still a fairly young girl, not just in age, but in life experience. So she and Samantha have that in common. And the two of them spend a lot of time together that first day or two. And she's not just comforting her, but they're getting to know each other. And they just automatically click, not to mention Blackbeard, the dog, who bonds everybody. I love Blackbeard. He was one of my most fun characters to write. I love dogs.
Yeah, he was
and
cute.
And he was
yeah.
special. So I think that all those things together, just, you know, between their likeness as human beings and their love for Drake and the circumstances. I think all those things just made for a much quicker friendship than life would normally unfold if it were not those circumstances.
Well, how did the servants react to her? I mean, now that they had to take care of her and do whatever she wanted, how did they feel about Alexandria?
I think that everybody loved Alex right away because she was not like that. She didn't act like a noble woman. She didn't demand those things. She didn't even know what to do with a lady's maid. It's kind of like, that's nice, but I don't really need one. And she treated everyone with the same kindness that she treated, not even just kindness, but equality that she did when she was with the men on board the ship. She just saw everybody as the same, and if they were good people, they were good people. So, I mean, Smitty already adored her, and her lady's maid adored her immediately because they just both, you know, again, she was a loving sort of a motherly type of a woman, and here's Alex, who's very broken in so many ways at this point and in need of comfort. And I think that vulnerability and that lack of, you know, looking down her nose and snobbery, those things together, everybody just took to her pretty much the way the men took to her on board the ship.
Well, it's amazing because her father was totally different. It's amazing. Her father felt that she was inferior, and his attitude towards women was she rebelled and she wanted to be her own person, and he didn't think that she had the right to decide anything for herself. And the fact that he was a snob is amazing that she didn't become a snob. That's so different.
You're right. I think that maybe it's because of that. Sometimes when you have a parent who's a certain way, you just want to be quite the opposite. And it's very hard. You know, I know that people think that the noble men and women grew up in a world that was so exemplary. And yeah, there is a fairy tale quality about it. But they also had their own strict rules, and especially for women. I mean, men were expected to just get married, produce an heir, and their job was done. They could do whatever they wanted. Whereas when you had the women, they were expected to obviously get married and produce the heir, but their entire life was supposed to be about, you know, more or less being their husband's chattel. And that's tough for somebody who's an independent-minded person.
Yeah, what would happen if she wanted to get a job, I wonder? Would he let her?
Oh, that never would have happened. Not in those days. Never. The only people who worked were the working class. And that's the other thing. The noble women were supposed to do all kinds of things, like sit and learn French and learn to crochet and knit and all the things. And she couldn't do any of that. She said that when she spoke, and where she sang, where she did any of the things that she was supposed to be doing, when she played her pianoforte, the hunting dogs would howl in the distance because the sound was so awful.
No, she was totally the opposite. I mean, I think if I had to crochet and knit and do all that too, I would lose my mind completely. It's just like a lot of people that are retired, like I retired from teaching when my mom got sick. So if I didn't do this, write book reviews in the radio, I think I would, you know, just go off and I don't even know. A lot of people that retire just eat, go on, you know, short vacations and then come back and eat some more and don't do very much or, you know, play Mahjong or whist or whatever. It's just not who I am. And, you know, you get criticized, like, why don't you do this? Well, this is more fun, to tell you the truth, being very honest.
And unfortunately, you had no choice then. So the fact that she was making a choice in spite of it was going to make her, you know, a pariah.
Well, before I forget, everybody that's listening out there, I know there's people listening. Thursday, we're going to be back on Thursday at 10 to talk about Samantha, and I'm not going to say anything more about that. You have to come and listen. And on Monday on Halloween, I've got Among the Shadows with Bruce Coffin. That's enough to scare you, and it's a really good book. And on November 29th, this is a very, very special interview. This author doesn't normally do them. It's the Lacey Spears murder. He sat down with her in prison. She's a young girl that decided that she was going to poison her son by putting salt in his feeding tube. And the things that she put this child through is more than criminal. And when the child died in the book, I could not believe that she actually said that she didn't do it, and that she was innocent. And she's still in prison for 20 years or whatever. and saying that she still didn't do it, that she literally killed the child, whereas no one in the hospitals and no one realized what she was doing. And every time the child got better, she did something to make him worse so that she would get noticed. On November 16th, I have Skin of Tattoos by Christina Haig. And on December 5th, I have Ethan Cross, the Judas Game. And on 12/8, one of my favorite people in the whole universe, John Land, Strong Cold Dead. And that's just some of what's coming up. And my show is booked until the end of February, which is really good. So, if there was a duel to the finish between Drake and Alexandria, who would win?
Oh, that's tough. Okay. I think if it were an emotional duel, I think eventually it would be Alex, only because I think that that in some ways he was more broken and damaged, and I think that kind of emotional side that she reached out to would wrap itself around him and she would win. I think that his love for her was pretty much his undoing, so to speak, at that point. I mean, I think he's a lot more bluster and less, you know, I think that there's an inner strength in both of them, but in her especially, to be able to put up with all she had to and then come around. I think that if it were a war of words, I think they'd kill each other. I don't know who would win. It would be like the War of the Roses. But as far as emotionally, I think that she probably would be the one. But I don't think she'd consider it winning. I think that she would consider it making him realize that he could trust her and that it's okay to love her.
How did you create the cover for this book? Is this the original one from 25 years ago, or is this a new one?
No, 25 years ago, everybody was doing, you know, the clinch covers, you know, where it was more of the buxom woman, you know, bent over backwards while the Duke held her. And actually, you know, as far as that first cover, I really, at the time, it was really beautiful because I watched the artists in those days. They didn't use clip art and things like that. They actually commissioned models, and they had historical wear that they put on, clothing, and they actually enacted the scene, and I watched it happen. I was on the set, and I was watching it. It was just amazing to see, and the painting was so beautiful that that the artist created it to. She created an oil, the painting itself, and then the painting became the cover. That my parents actually bought it for me as a gift, which was one of my most prized possessions at the time. Because unfortunately, I don't have them anymore. But at the time, I was so touched, and I still have it hanging in a place of honor. But when we redid the cover now, which we did. I wanted something precious, simple, and symbolic. That was really what I was looking for, and this sort of encompassed it because the seashell with the pearl and the heart kind of a feel was a combination of their love and the feeling of the Thousand Islands, and it symbolically represented them so well. I thought it was just a really beautiful cover. I unfortunately am not the artist, so I'm not capable. But I did talk back and forth with the artist. So
did you have a say in it? A lot of the authors are telling me that they don't have the power to decide what the cover is. But you did. You were able to decide if you like this cover or not. What would happen if you didn't like it? Would they listen or change it?
Usually, when you work with a conventional publisher, what happens is they either get. Nobody ever gets cover finale decision. What they get is cover consult, and that means that if they're working well with you, they'll ask for your opinion, and I've always been very lucky that way. So we've gone back and forth, and if there's been something I've hated, and there's honestly only one cover of all of my books that I hate, and I think that was the situation where unfortunately I think the art director was away, and it was one of those things where it happened where nobody could get to me in time. But usually they'll get to me, they'll show me things, and I'll either say, because I'm one of those people, I couldn't ever do it myself, but I can look at something and immediately decide if it's good or bad, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's like being an editor. But I can look at something and say, either that's beautiful or no, that just doesn't work. And you know, for this one, it really worked almost right from the beginning. There was one shell I didn't like as much as another shell, but that was about as far as it went.
No, I know. I self-published mine. I didn't. The first three of my Faces Behind the Stone series were traditionally published, but the fourth one I chose to cover myself, because I said this had to be like a cemetery with bodies, with stones, and it had like a face, like little faces on it. It's a scary cover, and I decided it on myself. But how did you, what about the back cover or the flap? Do you just decide what print they put on it? Because a lot of the authors are saying that they don't, and sometimes they give away too much.
I know. Well, the back cover copy is the original back cover copy as far as this, the story of that book.
Yeah.
Obviously, the bio is updated, but aside from that, and we did that together. My editor and I did that together, actually, when we did it. We wrote it together, and it was, the thing is that in some ways, it's better when the editor writes it than when you get someone on the outside, because unless that person really reads the book and knows the book, I always, wonder how you can write really good copy if you don't understand the book thoroughly. Whereas my editor obviously knew it inside out, and we did it together, and it just really, it clicked. I mean, she would do so. She would start with something and send it to me, and I would say, yes, this is great, or let's tweak this, or, we work really well together. So I've been fortunate that way. I really have. I have not had many adversarial relationships that have made it impossible to get a book done. I know I've heard the same horror stories you've heard.
Yeah. But what about, does the editor ever ask you to change anything in the story, change a storyline, or the storyline doesn't connect, or the storyline needs something? Do they ever change what you write, or you just get the changes and you change it yourself? Or do you have the right to say, no, it's going to stay that way?
What usually happens when I work well with an editor, with a good editor, is the editor will point things out, and it usually one of three things happens, and the third one is what usually happens. The first one is that I'll just say, you know what, you're right, and I'm changing it. The second one is I'm like, no, I can't change that because it would take away from this, this, or this, and it just doesn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
Or the third way, which is usually the way that works the best, is I'll sit, look at the change and I'll think, no, I wouldn't do that, but that does call for something different. They're right. What it was that he or she found is correct, that it's not right, but I have to be the one to figure out how to make this right. So their change per se isn't what I would choose to do, but the idea of the change is. So I think that you have to always be open to work with an editor. I don't think you can go into this business and say, this is mine, I'm not changing a thing. If I were self-published, I would still have somebody edit my books, because I think that it's important objective eye, an objective eye, go through it, because you're not objective. It's a kind of like it's your baby, and you can't be objective about it. So you need somebody who has that. And sometimes they'll find something blatant that you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe I had this person in two places at the same time, and I didn't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So with a good editor,
I have a great editor,
you work
too,
with a good editor. Yeah, when you're self-published, obviously, you can go pick your editor, so that helps.
Yeah, Maxine Breidenbach is fantastic. And what I love about her is that she'll go through the book like 100 times if I ask her to. And she's separate from my self-publishing, and even though it costs, and she's not expensive. I mean, even for 100 pages or 200 pages, she's not even $100 to edit the book, which is fantastic. And she'll go through it as many times as I want, and then she'll say to me, read it over, and she'll leave it on the side for comments. And say, well, you didn't really write that. You got to fix that. And most of the time she's right. Or I just write, and then I'll say to her, you get to tell me what I did wrong because I can't read on my computer. So once it's typed, it's done. And then she fixes
What's her
it,
name?
And I'll tell her.
Maxine
Breidenbach. She's on Facebook. She is probably the most amazing person. I drive her crazy. I have to often type term papers for my nieces and my nephews, and after I type them, I say to her, Maxine, just check my mistakes because I can't read on my computer. Literally, I get eye strain. And she's
That's
fantastic.
Really
she's fantastic.
Does she have a freelance business? Is that what she does?
Yeah, that's what she does. She edits books, and if I ask her to do something, like right away, she'll do it. As a matter of fact, my magazine that I want to tell you about is coming out, hopefully next month. MJ9 is for authors, writers, readers. If anybody has writing tips, publishing tips, speak out about the election. Anybody want to speak out about that? Television, movie reviews, and anything. It's my magazine. It's in memory of my sister that died 6 years ago. And she's the reason I'm doing this. Because at one point I was like almost 200 pounds, but I'm far from that. Now I'm skinny. And she said, either you're going to become a couch potato or you're going to review books. And I said, but I'm the one taking care of your mother and you're going to work. It's not fair. I retired from teaching after a million years and I loved every minute of it, but somebody had to be there to monitor what was happening with my mother. So I decided to review books. And I reviewed a cookbook and I don't cook. So that was hilarious to start with. But I'm going to talk about Samantha. Tell us a little bit about it before we go, and when everyone can learn more about your work, and when are you writing the next murder book?
Okay, as far as Samantha, that's Sammy, having seen Drake and Alex and their love, has decided that she wants the love of her life too, and she's been immersed in all these gothic kind of romance-oriented novels. She would be a Jane Austen person. And she's decided that she's going to find the man of her dreams. So that's the premise of what we're going to talk about on Thursday when she goes out to, as a grown woman, 18 years old, and off to start her first London season. She's not interested in all the parties and everything else. She's interested in finding her hero. So that's really what we're going to talk about. That's for a starter. And then on as she meets Remington, which is another interesting match. So we'll get a chance to talk about that. And as far as me, the first thing I would say is go to AndreaKane.com because from there you can connect with me on Facebook and Twitter and all the, you know, Goodreads and all the places that you can find me and read, you know, because I try to be on, especially, it's interesting because I do tweet, but I spend a lot of time on Facebook because I find that my readers want to communicate. They want to have a conversation and talk to me about things, and you really can't do that on Twitter. It's more of a little, you know, tweet out something and I'll tell everybody what's going on. But when people want to interact about a new book or ask me something about a current book or some of the questions you and I have talked about My Heart's Desire or about, you know, writing thrillers versus writing historical, things like that. Because I have some readers who love one and not the other. And then I have some who followed me straight through and made the transition with me. So, you know, people want to have a communication with someone they read and love, and I think that that's their right. So I enjoy talking to my readers. So I am on social media, and you can find me there. And as I said, the best place would be AndreaKane.com. You can also connect to buying any of the books there, reading about any of my books there. So I think we're going to be unveiling a new website at the beginning of the year, but this one is good, and it has everything you need on it.
Well, if you want to write an article for my magazine, that would be great. Also, I can email you. I do panel shows. And the first one I'm going to do in January, this is not the first panel show I've done, is on point of view and voice. We're going to talk about how you create point of view and voice in your novels. We're going to talk about, on another one, we're going to talk about fear and hate and how you create that in your villain and in your main characters. It's just something that everybody says is different. We're going to talk about the technology that mystery writers use, you know, hacking, computer experts, cell phones, and other types of technology that they use in their writing, what real-life experiences do you create in your plot. And then we're going to go to the literary elements of keeping the character interest, language and dialect, and the difference between mood and tone, and a whole bunch more. And, of course, there are people that write in first-person narrative, second, third, or use more dialogue. And those are just some of the ideas that I have for panel shows. And I've got a whole bunch of people
wonderful.
That said they
would. What you're doing is
so
wonderful.
You're
broadening things, and I think that's great. And it just occurred to me, I didn't answer your question, now that you just said that. My next Forensic Instincts novel will be out, I think, sometime later on in 2017, because I'm still working on it now. I'm such a diehard perfectionist that until everything's exactly the way I want it to be, it doesn't come out. But that's when, you and I will talk more about Forensic Instincts at the time that we're talking about my thrillers. But that's probably when you'll be seeing my next psychological thriller.
Oh, I know. The Murder That Never Was is fantastic. And guys
out there,
if you haven't read it, I don't know what's wrong with you. What happens is the people are partners in crime. They're the best in the whole universe, Cheryl and Gina and Wendy, and they are amazing, and they hound me. You know, friend, you have to join this book tour. Even if I don't want to, they just send it anyway. So I just give up. I just gave up and just send it. Put me on the schedule sometime, and I'll let you know if I can do it. And I usually manage to do it because there's not one book that they've ever sent me that I didn't like. And when it came to My Heart's Desire, I think they emailed me about 10 times. I go, okay, I was going to do it. Just tell me when I'm doing it. And I was really thrilled and honored that you wanted to do the interview. That really made my day. I said I needed something happy. So I want to thank you so much, and I really appreciate this, and I can't wait to talk again on Thursday about Samantha, and I will email you the list of panel shows, so if there's anything that you want to join, I'm going to start them in January, probably do like one a month, something like that, so you can tell me what month is good.
And oh, please do. And the other thing is there a link that I can listen to this to our pod show?
Yes, I can send that to you too. I know how to do these things. I do these things on my phone. I email people the link to the show on my phone. For some reason, it just works better. Actually, you know what? I can go. Yeah, I can do this. No problem. And I know
I have news for you. If I don't do something right away, forget it. I mean, I have to do it the minute I think of it.
Too.
Otherwise, I have to write it down because otherwise it's gone.
Me too. And then what I do is I have my calendar on my phone, and it just reminds me. The Google Calendar is fantastic.
Yes.
It just says, you have to do this today or else. You will do that, and it reminds you until you do it. It's impossible.
I know.
So thank you so much, and I really appreciate
it. Oh, it was my
pleasure. Everyone,
I really enjoyed this very much.
Me too. I haven't had so much fun in a long time. This is a great interview, and I'm looking
and
forward
we get
to talking
more
about
fun in 2 days.
That's exactly right, and I'm looking forward to it, too. So, everybody, have a great day. The sun is shining. It's a little cold out there, but you'll get over it. Just put on a warm coat, and have a nice day, and bye.
Bye-bye.